I'm having one of those weeks. In fact, our family's having one of those weeks. Sarah, my darling wife, about last weekend, she decided to play with the kids in the park across the road. This game that involved jumping over seesaws. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So at her first turn, she jumped, landed awkwardly, and did pretty close to a stage 3 tear of her ligaments in her ankle, and so it blew up. No, not that big. Blew up quite a lot. And it's bruising all up and down. And then gastro's had its way in the PS household this week. It's really awesome. So don't come anywhere near me. The kid's dropping like flies. In fact, it got to the point this morning. I woke up, went into the family room, and the cat had vomited everywhere. So there's so much vomit in our house. The cat is vomiting. Which brings me to the story of Joseph, who didn't have sick cats, but he often had one of those weeks, but turbocharged, yeah? So if you've got a Bible with you, would you open up to Genesis chapter 37? And just sort of bouncing off how Heather started last week, I just want to dig into this story because over and over and over again in Joseph's story, there's this question that keeps surfacing again and again. And it's a question that deeply impacted the way that Joseph experienced life and experienced faith and experienced God. In fact, whatever Joseph faced, whether it was battle or breakthrough, whether it was opportunity or threat, over and over he would return to this question, this single conviction that framed his life. And so when circumstances spiraled out of control, no matter how bad things got, and if you are feeling bad about your life sometimes, read some of Joseph's life and you'll feel better about what's going on with you. But whatever happened, he'd return again and again to this core conviction, this core question. And ultimately, after years of trial and tribulation, he became the prime minister of ancient Egypt, second only to the Pharaoh, in power and in wealth. But even as his circumstances changed like that, he repeatedly came back to this single core question, this single core conviction. And even as Genesis gets to its climactic chapters and he faces the people who have hurt him most, and he is in a unique position where he can pay them back in full, again, he returns to this key question. And the question is this: what would someone in these circumstances do if they were convinced that God was with them? You see, every time his circumstances changed, every time things went pear-shaped, or every twist and every turn, Joseph somehow had the state of mind, the presence of mind, to ask, what would anybody do facing what I'm facing if they were truly confident that God was with them? And this is a principle that we're going to see, that when you respond in your circumstances as if God is with you, then you will see him in your circumstances. Not because believing somehow sort of magically makes him appear, but believing actually enables us to see him because he is already there. And so often we just let circumstances distort our vision or our response to circumstances so much that we miss the God who is with us. And so Heather started last week reading out of Genesis chapter 37. And we looked at Joseph, who was Jacob's favorite son. And everybody knew it because there was this incredible robe that in some moment of madness and dysfunctional, toxic madness, Jacob decided to give this to Joseph as a sign to everybody, all the brothers, that Joseph was the favorite. And the text says that the brothers hated Joseph and they were jealous of him. And so we're going to pick up the story in verse 12 of Genesis 37. And it says this: now Joseph's brothers had gone to graze their father's flocks near Shechem. And Israel, the other name of Jacob, said to Joseph, as you know, your brothers are grazing the flocks near Shechem. So come, I'm going to send you to them. Very well, he replied. And so he said to him, go and see if all is well with your brothers and with their flocks and bring word back to me. And then he sent him off from the valley of Hebron. And the story continues in verse 17 and says, "So Joseph went after his brothers and found them near Dothan. But they saw him in the distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. 'Here comes that dreamer,' they said to each other. 'Come now, let's kill him and throw him into one of these cisterns and say that a ferocious animal devoured him. Then we'll see what comes of his dreams.'" This is the depth of the darkness in this family. This is the hopelessness and the toxicity of the relationships between these brothers. And then almost perversely, in this moment, Reuben has a change, one of Joseph's brothers, Reuben has a change of heart and says, no, let's just throw him in a cistern. Because that, in his mind, is an act of mercy. That's what stuff is like right now. So verse 23 continues. "So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the ornate robe he was wearing, and they took him and threw him into the cistern. And the cistern was empty. There was no water in it." Then look what it says. "As they sat down to eat their meal," they've just thrown their brother into a well, and now the first thing they do is stop and have lunch together. Can you imagine what this is like? You've got Joseph at the bottom of this cistern, this well. He's going, "Let me out, let me out, let me out." And the brothers are going, Did you hear anything, Judah?" "No, didn't hear anything. Could you please pass the sandwiches?" "Absolutely, my brother." "Get me out, let me out, let me out." It's perverse. So as they sat down to their meal, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. And their camels were loaded with spices, balm, and myrrh, and they were on their way to take them down to Egypt. And Judah said to his brothers, "What will we gain if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him. After all, he is our brother, our own flesh and blood." And his brothers agreed. And so when the Midianite merchants came by, his brothers pulled Joseph up out of the cistern and sold him for 20 shekels of silver to the Ishmaelites, who took him to Egypt. Now, at this point in the story, you have to ask a few questions. I mean, would God allow this to happen to somebody that he cared anything about? I mean, you have to ask yourself, what has Joseph actually done? He's bragged about a few dreams, but he's 17 years old after all. And it wasn't his fault that his dad loved him more than the rest. It certainly wasn't his fault that his dad not only told everybody that Joseph was his favorite, but gave him a robe. It wasn't his fault he'd been given this robe. And it wasn't his fault that he had brought back a bad report. I mean, he wasn't a perfect son, but you have to be reasonable. This boy has just been stripped of everything he's owned, and now he's caught up in human trafficking. And in a moment, his future is completely different. And not because of anything that he has done. Maybe that reflects what's going on in your world at the moment. Maybe in your work life. Maybe relationships, dynamics in your workplace. Maybe that's difficult and almost impossible. And things are not going your way. And stuff in work isn't working out for you. Maybe it's working out for people and actually doing the right thing. You're trying to do the right thing. And stuff's going on that's not your fault. Maybe there's family tension going on in your home right now. And it's not your fault. Decisions have been made, but it wasn't you. You're actually being impacted by the consequences of other people's decisions. You see, this was certainly Joseph's position in life. And so the story kicks on in chapter 39, verse 1. It says this. "Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there." And then this phrase, and it's like a phrase that repeats all the way through Joseph's story. It says, verse 2, "The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master." And this expression, "the Lord was with Joseph," it sounds almost out of place with regards to everything else that is going on. Because it would be easy to think that if the Lord was with Joseph, then he would be back home with his mum and dad. It'd be easy to think that if the Lord was with Joseph, then he would have his robe, that beautiful robe, back. It'd be easy to think that if the Lord was with Joseph, then his brothers would be in Egypt making pyramids. But the phrase carries this sense that this is what defined Joseph's life. And that's important because it meant that Joseph had this capacity, this presence and state of mind where he could find God in the middle of whatever was going on. And it simply changed the way he experienced life and experienced faith and experienced God. Well, the story goes on in verse 3. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. And Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything he owned. This is interesting because so often I've seen this again and again and again in life. It's where people, where they find God, where they stay faithful, where they persevere and keep going and don't quit and put everything on the fact that God is and always will be faithful. Something unusual happens in them and people around them can see what is going on. They can see the difference it makes in the way that people experience life and faith and God. And so Potiphar, who doesn't even believe in Joseph's God, and actually, as you read through the story, you can't escape the conclusion that Joseph actually doesn't know very much about his God. But Potiphar could see the effect, the way this guy lived his life, the way he responded to circumstances, the way he made decisions, the way he lived his life was different. And this is how it always is with people who simply do what anyone would do if they were convinced that God was with them. I think of one of my friends, one of my oldest friends, and a number of years ago their marriage spiraled out of control and it eventually ended up in separation and divorce, and there was no reconciliation. It's a desperately sad set of circumstances. And in so many ways, they didn't really understand how it had all unraveled so dramatically and so awfully. But it was just amazing to watch them live their life through this season of life, right up until now, but through that, through the darkest times, they continually turned back to God and say, "He is faithful, He is faithful." And it truly changed the most awful of circumstances, but it changed their experience of God and life and faith and people around them. People around them saw it again and again and again. Verse 5 says this, "From the time he put him in charge of this household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the house of the Egyptian because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field." And to capture the sense of irony in these words here is incredible. It captures this tension because what happens is God doesn't bless Joseph. God blesses the Egyptian slave owner. And you have to understand something about Joseph. He's not fatalistic or passive. Oh, just whatever happens, I'll just be great. Oh, thank you for me being thrown in prison. I'm so grateful. It's just really, really good. You must be with me. He didn't live life like that. And there's this tension in this language. God, why wouldn't you bless me? I mean, thank you that you're with me, but can't you bless me? But you see, every day when that sort of thinking and that dynamic started to take shape, what Joseph would do every day, he would ask, what would anybody in these circumstances do if they were confident that God was with them? And every day it changed the way he lived life. So verse 6 is next, and we know this story, but it says this. Now Joseph was well built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." So now it takes an even greater turn for the worse because he's yet again in a no-win situation. Whichever way he goes here, it's a disaster. He gives into temptation. He gives into these sexual advances. Eventually it will unravel and he'll be punished, maybe even executed. And if he stands up and takes that stand of integrity, he runs the risk of offending Potiphar's wife, and he doesn't know what on earth will happen if that's the case. And it's quite extraordinary in this moment with what he's about to say, because we see up close how Joseph faced up when things went from bad to worse. And it's actually incredible because here's this guy far away from family and far away from land, and he doesn't have a Bible. and he doesn't have church, and he doesn't have theology books. In fact, all he's got to go on, all he's ever grown up on, is just some random stories about his great-grandfather, Abraham. That's it. So in a lot of ways, it almost could have been his faith hanging by a thread. But this is his response. Verse 8. But he refused. "With me in charge," he told her, "my master does not concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" And you have to ask, why in the world, in the middle of all of this, would he declare his commitment to God? In the middle of this disaster waiting to happen, far away from family, far away from land, where it actually looks more like God has abandoned him again and again, why would he express his faith in God right now? And it's actually really simple, because this maybe by now 20-something-year-old kid understood something that everybody else missed, that sometimes you and I miss. So he realized that his responsibility wasn't to sort everything out. His responsibility wasn't to figure everything out or try and re-engineer his circumstances. His responsibility was very simple, though it wasn't easy. And this was his question. What would anybody in these circumstances do if they were confident that God was with them? And so he says, "I can't do this, because to do this would be to sin against my God." And so, in this incredible moment, Joseph remains faithful to God. And so you'd think God would reward him. Verse 10. And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even be with her. One day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. And she caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. And when she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. "Look," she said to him, "this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us." Oh, she's so humiliated. She trumps up these false charges of sexual assault. Drags everybody else in. Totally frames Joseph. And verse 19 says, "So when his master heard the story his wife told him, saying, 'This is how your slave treated me,' he burned with anger, and Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined." And so Joseph is punished for the very thing that he had the self-control not to do. So verse 20 continues, and it says this, "But while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden." It's deeply ironic language, don't you think? God was with him again. There in prison was with him. But more than that, he granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. I don't want to know a prison warden, let alone be granted favor with a prison warden. But God was with him. And so you know what Joseph did when he was in prison? He did what anybody would do in this new set of circumstances who was sure that God was with them. Verse 20, continues and says, "So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care, because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did." And so once again, a prison warden notices something unusual about this guy. And this is what we understand. This is what we learn. It's only when we trust and look for God in the circumstances that we find him. It's only when we respond to our circumstances, whatever is going on, but we respond to them as if God is with us, then we see him in there. It's only when we expect this that we experience this. And it's only when we accept this is true that we experience it for ourselves. I don't want to just leave Joseph in the dungeon at this point, because the story continues, and as Joseph is running the prison, there are two new prisoners who come. They're the king's cupbearer and baker. And they're there for a while and probably become friends with Joseph. And at one point, there's this night when they both have dreams. And it's the word on the street around the prison is that Joseph interprets dreams. And so they come to him and say, "Can you interpret our dreams?" And he says, "Sure." And he's interpreting the cupbearer's dream, which basically means that he's going to be released in 3 days, which the cupbearer is very excited. The irony is that the baker then wants his dream interpreted, and he says, "Well, in 3 days you're going to get executed." So it doesn't quite end so well for the baker. But as he's interpreting the cupbearer's dream, there are these words that come out of Joseph's mouth that actually indicate the levels of frustration and disappointment and reality of what's been going on in his life. That, like, he continually turns back to God, but there are levels of frustration and disappointment that he experiences. He's not Superman. But it says this in chapter 40, verse 14. "But when all goes well with you, remember me and show me kindness. Mention me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison. I was forcibly carried off from the land of the Hebrews. And even here I have done nothing to deserve being put in a dungeon." Can you hear the tension in his voice? Years this has been going on. And finally, maybe a window of opportunity. And surely this guy will be grateful. Surely. Well, the cupbearer is restored and the baker is executed. But it says this, chapter 40 ends with these words, verse 23. "But the chief cupbearer, however, did not remember Joseph. He forgot him." And now we go from the sublime to the ridiculous. It's almost inconceivable. There is now no rhyme nor reason to what is going on. And so Joseph now has probably another 2 years to contemplate what's happening to him. His brothers sell him. Potiphar's wife frames him, and now the cupbearer to the king forgets him. And every day he's going to have to face the question that faces us every single day. Am I going to define God by my ability to interpret circumstances, or am I going to find God and respond to God based on what he has promised me? Am I going to trust my ability to interpret circumstances, or am I going to trust his faithfulness? And he says again and again and again, "I am with you." And so we need to ask ourselves this question. With the circumstances that we're facing, what would anybody do who was absolutely sure that God was with them? Every challenge, every opportunity, every time maybe a family member or a friend offends us, we can reframe our experience of life and of God and of faith every single time by asking this question. Okay, there's a whole lot of stuff I want to do. Like, I'm angry. I feel slighted. It's not just. And it's not like you're denying reality, but you're reframing your experience of God. What would anybody do in the circumstances you face right now? What is the next step? The next logical step, the next step of obedience. What is the next step that anybody would take who's convinced that God is with them? And again, it opens up, even in some of the most difficult of circumstances, it opens up a way forward with God and through God and towards God, because he is with us. See, in this moment, Joseph didn't know that he would be released from prison. He was staring another 2 years. In fact, it wasn't just trumped up charges now. He'd been forgotten. There's no hope. He had no idea what was ahead of him. And yet he stayed faithful. I mean, maybe he's thinking, "I'm just trying to do the right thing. I'm just, every step of the way, I'm just trying to do the right thing. This is not my fault. But again, I'm going to turn back. Again, I'm going to turn back. Again, I'm going to turn back." It makes me think of the prisons that in a number of centuries would face the apostles, all of them faced imprisonment at one time or another. Peter, Paul, imprisoned for doing the right thing, for staying faithful, for doing what anybody would do who was confident that God was with them. And they were both, well, Peter and Paul were both executed ultimately. Jesus, every step of the way, taking that step of faithfulness, of obedience, and he ended crucified on a cross. So this side of the grave, it didn't work out. But the truth of Jesus' life and death is that he was raised on the third day. The truth, the defining truth of Peter and Paul's life was that they had eternal life. And they look forward, as we do, to that future resurrection. So I can't stand here and say, hey, if you take this piece from Joseph's life, that everything is going to work out absolutely beautifully for you. I can't look you in the face and say that, but what I can say is this. If you will ask yourself every day, whatever's going on in your circumstances, and maybe you're just trying to do the right thing, and there are levels of frustration and disappointment, but even in the midst of that, if you can ask the question, what would anybody do in your circumstances who is sure that God was with them? If you take that next step and you do that day after day, what I can say is this, it will change the way you experience God, fundamentally change the way you experience him, the way you experience life, and will change the way that you experience faith. Would you bow your heads and would you pray with me? Father, thank you that there are hundreds of people in this room, but you have your eyes on and your arms open to every single one of us, no matter what is going on. And I thank you that again and again and again, and please help our hearts hear this and get gripped with this conviction, but again and again and again you say you are with us. And so, Father, with the so many different circumstances, Lord God, we couldn't even name all of them. But Father, what I want to ask is that you would grip our hearts with the truth and the conviction that you are with us. Why don't you just quietly, maybe just in your heart of hearts, just thank him. Say, thank you that you are with me. Thank you. And hold on to that truth. And let it frame the question, what is the next step? Because God is with you. Maybe it's a difficulty in relationships, family, parents worried about their children. God is with you. What do you do next? Financial pressure getting on top of you? God is with you. Maybe you need to experience or give forgiveness. That could be the truth that sets you free. God is with you. It changes everything. Father, I just commit my brothers and sisters into your hands in Jesus' name.